full well.
It's not. I asked her for that. So be careful.
We should tell these guys this is something. No. Look at this. Well, my sister guys from the AIDS group, they got the first.
Which amendment are we?
I mean, that's okay.
He has a
he's
going to
make
us four.
The okay, dash yeah, four is makes announcement.
The call, the House Committee on Health Care to Order.
Where they put it on.
March 29th. And just to, in case you're wondering what's happening, this equipment will not go on till the CART representative comes. And then the equipment will go on. So don't worry about not being on now. It will be on when the time is right. I plan on working a few bills first to get them out of the way. And we'll be dealing with. What's the bill on the PUC? What's the number?
3268.
We'll be dealing with 3268 last in our agenda, so we can provide whatever time is left for people who want to testify on that bill. And that will come.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I will have to leave at some point at 3:30-ish to go testify on a bill, but then I'll be back. So we should have plenty of time to do the work session.
Right.
So is there... Did somebody say they can't hear?
Yeah, we can't hear. Stop!
Okay.
Microphones might not be working.
I don't know if we can get media volume. Do our best.
I'll try and project, and we'll see what we can do.
That's better.
All right. We are going to carry over the work session on House Bill 2882. First item on the agenda.
The bond.
Are you carrying up?
Carrying that over till...
at least Monday.
It has to be Monday.
Can we carry it over? Oh, that's right, carry it over to the next meeting. Carry it over to Monday.
That's right.
We're going to, on a couple of them, we're going to adopt some amendments and then carry the bill over, because when we adopt the amendments, that will end our ability to work it, because we won't have the paperwork we need to do it. So let me open a work session on House Bill 2339. For the purpose of adopting the dash two amendments.
You ready for a motion,
Mr.
Chair?
We're ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the amendment, the dash two amendment to House Bill 2339, dated March 20th, 2017.
Representative Nose moves, we adopt the dash two amendments dated March 17th, 17. And is there any discussion on that motion? Can we tell us what that motion does, please?
And Bueller has a question.
Representative Bueller?
Yeah, Chair Greenlick, I agree with you. This is a problem that needs to be solved, but I'll be voting no. I have great concerns that the reference to the Medicare pricing doesn't keep up with inflation, and it's a political number, not a number based on real cost of delivering care. And I think it gives too much leverage to payers against providers.
Okay. Is there any other discussion?
Another hand, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Chair. I tend to be in favor of this, but I wondered if it would be good to have DCBS come up and explain it. Because I thought this took it out of trying to find what is customary on the part of insurers, which is also not always a neutral setting. Is it worth having them explain?
Explain this? What?
Explain the dash two.
All dash two does is say the payment will be at 175% of Medicare.
Yep.
I'd be happy to have them explain, but what's to explain?
Well, why? They oversee the insurance division, and so why they would, why that might be a more reasonable way to go than doing what customary based on what insurance rates already are.
They want it on the record.
Or maybe you could explain that.
Well, I'm not sure there is any current. What's happening now is that when people show up in a place that they think was a part of a network, and then they find out that the anesthesiologist wasn't, they get a bill.
Right.
And they end up having to pay that bill because the insurance isn't covering. So what's happening now is, I mean, what this bill says, the insurance does have to cover it.
Right.
They have to pay it at a certain rate, and the recipient has to accept that rate. Now, the question is, how much should that rate be? That's the
right.
discussion.
May comment.
Yes,
yeah,
please.
I agree with Chair Green. Like, this is a problem, and it, I think we all agree on the solution. It's just what is that reference point?
What do you
point?
Peg it to?
It's
and I
the
think
price.
Pegging it to the Medicare rate doesn't reflect the true value. That's a political number. It doesn't keep up with inflation. And it gives too much leverage to payers because if they know you are pegged at Medicare, and I would make the contention that 175%. Medicare is probably lower than what a lot of the contracted rates are for private payers already. So,
Is lower than the in-network rate. It's definitely lower than that.
Yeah. So that gives enormous power to the payer to bring people in the network, and sometimes that's at a pretty low rate. So that's my concern.
Did he already do the others?
No.
This one's carried over.
Let me ask the maker of the motion to withdraw the motion, please.
Mr. Chair, I would like to withdraw the motion that I made asking the committee to adopt the two amendments to House Bill 2339 dated March 20th, 2017.
The motion is withdrawn. I close the work session on House Bill 2339 and open a work session on House Bill 2388. Madam Minister, what do we have in this one?
Mr. Chair, members.
Did I announce to carry that over also till Monday?
You can
do that right now.
Yeah, carry that over.
I think you just did.
I wasn't sure whether I did or not.
No, you didn't, but now you did.
We are carrying that over until Monday.
2339.
That's correct.
Okay, Monday. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2388 had a public hearing on February 15th. This bill requires that the Department of Consumer and Business Services to deny, revoke, or suspend a pharmacy benefit manager to conduct business in Oregon if the PBM fails to comply with applicable statutes, rules, or orders. This has an emergency clause effective on passage. What you have before you are the -1 amendments, which adds a clearer and more precise definition of pharmacy, and you have the -4 amendment, which basically replaces the measure. It grants DCBS authority to deny, revoke, or suspend a PBM registration. Specifies conditions that the registration can be denied, revoked, or suspended. It also directs DCBS to adopt the rules for the process where the pharmacy or a pharmacy representative can file a complaint against a PBM. It removes the cap on the fees that DCBS may charge for PBMs to register or renew the registration. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have fiscals and revenues on the -1s and -4s. They both are no revenue impact and minimal impact for fiscals.
I would like, if we have a DCBS representative, to come up and talk to us about this one for a moment. Is there somebody in the audience that can do that?
For the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, Policy Manager of the Division of Financial Regulation. Be happy to take any questions on the bill.
Have we achieved relative consensus on this at the moment? Or
I believe, Mr. Chair, as far as the bill goes, I believe that there's more or less consensus. There may be a few issues that are minor outstanding issues that can be addressed on the Senate side. But my understanding is that the bill in its form is pretty close.
So.
That's my understanding too, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank, before we get on with this, all the parties that are involved. That includes the PBMs as well as the Pharmacy Association and DCBS and Mr. Blackwell. I think this has been a long time coming, and I'm very happy about it.
Representative Kennemer?
I'm on board with the fours.
No, I'm sorry. I was just...
I'm sorry.
I didn't mean...
Okay,
to.
Great. Well, let's have a couple of motions.
All right, Mr. Chair, I would like to move that we amend House Bill 2388 with the -1 amendments dated February 24th, 2017.
Representative Notes moves we adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated February 24th, 2017 to House Bill 2388. Is there any discussion on that amendment? Is there any objection? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make another motion. Please, I would like to move that we amend House Bill 2388 with the Dash 4 amendments dated March 27, 2017.
Representative Notes moves we adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated 3-27-17 to House Bill 2388. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. Representative Notes, you have a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that the committee adopt House Bill 2388 and send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation based on the amendments to the Dash 1 and the Dash 4.
Representative Notes moves we adopt approve House Bill 2388 as amended with a Dash 1 and a Dash 4 and send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We have all the paperwork on that?
Yes,
are we ready
do,
to
Mr.
move
Chair.
That?
Yes.
Is there any discussion on this? I would like to thank Representative Nose on this and DCBS. This has been a long and complicated process, and I'm glad we're moving.
Yes. Three terms.
That's about par. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kettimer.
Aye.
Representative Malmstrom.
Aye.
Representative Pack.
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Yes.
Chair Freeman.
Yes. Motion carries. Representative Nose, will you carry it on the floor?
Yes, I will.
Close the work session on House Bill 2388 and open a work session on House Bill 2124. No, wait a minute. That was, well,
2114.
Yeah, we don't have the paperwork on that, do we?
No, but you wanted to adopt the amendment.
Yeah. I'm open a work session on 2114 and ask whether the committee's had a chance to look at the Dash 6 amendments to the bill.
I have.
Are you comfortable
I'm comfortable with the Dash 6.
Anybody else?
Let's amend it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would...
I did. I opened the work session on 2124.
All right, Mr. Chair, I would like to move that we amend House Bill 2114 with the Dash 6 amendment dated March 29th, 2017.
Representative Nose moves we adopt the Dash 6 amendments dated March 29th, 2017 to House Bill 2114. That's an amendment that's worked out. I know the OMA is relatively happy with that now, or they're at least okay with it.
I see them in the back smiling.
They're smiling in the back there. Always good to see happy faces. I think this is a reasonable compromise to what we had in the original bill, and I recommend the Dash 6. Any other discussion on the Dash 6? Any objection? So moved. We'll carry over this bill also till Monday so we get paperwork. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2114. Let me take stock of where we are. Oh. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3363. Madam Administrator, what do we have on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3363 comes at the request of Representative Noble. The bill changes the term osteopath to osteopathic physician, clarifies that doctors of osteopathic medicine practice medicine as physicians. And Mr. Chair, on the original bill, there is no fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Please.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, and Hayden, and members of the committee. And community. My name is Ron Noble. I'm the state representative for District 24, McMinnville through up through Hillsboro. And I'm sitting before you today, I know not to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway, for really a relatively simple bill.
Feels that way, but sometimes those relatively simple ones go south.
So the intent is really to provide some recognition to a group of professionals in our state and to change the term in statute from osteopath to osteopathic physician. There is no scope of practice change, simply to change how they are recognized in our statute. And I think it's appropriate, especially since we have a College of Osteopathic Medicine in this state, that this spring will graduate its third class, something that is personally to me proud of. My son is a graduate of that school and currently practicing as an intern in general surgery at OHSU. But it provides an opportunity to recognize a group of men and women who are professionals and ascribe to being physicians. I say simple. It's 39 pages long, the bill is, and it's long because it modifies 41 statutes. We did consult with the Oregon Medical Association, and our intent is not to change the scope, but they had a few questions, and I understand there's an amendment forthcoming to ensure that we are not changing the scope of anyone's practice, osteopathic, medical, or any other host of medical providers. And with that, I would be glad to hand over any questions to Sabrina Riggs.
Great.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sabrina Riggs. I'm here representing the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon, also known as OPSO. OPSO is a group comprised of over 1,500 osteopathic physicians, residents, and medical students in Oregon who are all dedicated to providing top-level comprehensive care to Oregon's patients. Osteopathic physicians, or DOs, are physicians and are equivalent to MDs. They go through all of the same undergraduate medical school and residency requirements that MDs do. And they're also covered in ORS 677, that chapter that covers both MDs and DOs. This bill is intended to be pretty simple. It's a housekeeping bill that changes the way osteopathic physicians are referenced in statute, as Representative Noble said. The aim is really just to be more consistent throughout ORS. In some cases, currently, they're listed as osteopaths, or the practice of osteopathic medicine is listed as osteopathy. We would like to see that change to either osteopathic physician or doctor of osteopathic medicine. In some cases, DOs would be removed entirely, and it would just reference physician license under ORS 677. We are working with the OMA to make sure that they're comfortable with the language, and we are trying to be very clear that this is not an attempt to change scope at all. It would be great if we could wait until we get the amendments in to work this bill, please. Take any questions if you've got them.
Anybody have any questions? That's fine. We'll just close the public hearing and reschedule when we get the amendments we need.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3363 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3086. Representative Maelstrom, are you going to lead us on this one?
Yes. Thank you, Chair.
Do you want to have a stick?
Will you tell us what the bill is, Madam Administrator?
I'll go first and then you go.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3086 comes to us at the request of Representative Maelstrom, requires that health benefit plans to reimburse the cost of treatment for HIV-associated lipodystrophy. This declares an emergency effective on passage. Give us our details.
Go for it.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sherry Maelstrom. I represent Oregon House District 27, which includes Beaverton and Southwest Portland. I am here today to testify in support of HB 3086, which would require insurers to reimburse providers for treatment of HIV-associated lipodystrophy. While many of those infected with HIV in the 1980s have died from the illness related to infections, there are many long-term survivors who were saved by treatments developed in the 1990s. These treatments significantly extended their lives, but it came at a cost, namely lipodystrophy. HIV-related lipodystrophy is a metabolic consequence of taking antiretroviral therapy cocktails prescribed for HIV infection. Lipodystrophy includes lipoatrophy, lipohypertrophy, and mixed syndrome. Estimates of Oregonians living with lipodystrophy are difficult to find, but the Oregon Health Authority estimates that 30% of HIV-positive individuals experience some level of syndrome.
Lipoatrophy consists of wasting of fatty tissues in areas meant to have fatty deposits. Atrophic changes consist of subcutaneous fat atrophy in the legs, buttocks, arms, and notable facial wasting. Lipohypertrophy consists of building up of fatty tissues in areas not meant to have fat deposits. Hypertrophic changes consist of excess fat deposits, commonly around the abdominal region, but also in the neck, shoulders, and often called the buffalo hump. Mixed syndrome affects the body's ability to properly process lipids or fats, leading to dyslipidemia or unbalanced fats and cholesterols in the bloodstream, which dramatically increases chances of heart attack or stroke. While Oregon administrative rules provide for equitable coverage under life and health insurance policies for conditions related to HIV infection, they do not necessarily ensure that procedures that could be considered cosmetic are covered under all programs, especially for individuals that suffer from job insecurity based on their physical appearance. That said, there is precedence. The governor of Massachusetts recently signed Senate Bill 2137 into law, which had similar provisions to HB 3086, which is available on OLIS. While wealthy men and women can receive injections of products such as Restylane, Sculptra, Juvederm to combat the effects of aging, many some you may know of med spas, they're called, and you go and look younger from these things. People that are suffering from lipodystrophy cannot afford to pay those expenses out of pocket to address the underlying health issue that negatively impacts their personal and professional lives. Today, we will be hearing from a few long-term survivors and the complications associated with early HIV treatments. We have, besides those speaking, there's other members of a group called Let's Kick Ass. The S stands for the AIDS Survivor Syndrome. One of them is a former colleague of mine from Multnomah County Health Department, who I saw struggle for years to get his lipodystrophy covered, while our community partners often question me about his health. It puts people in a really awkward position. People, you know, would ask me as the nurse in a multidisciplinary team, was he okay? What's the matter with him? I can't divulge his health status. I can't pretend I don't notice. So it's a very difficult thing for people in the workplace to deal with. I recognize that there are providers and insurers that cover some for HIV-associated lipodystrophy, and I'm open to working with the good actors to find possible amendments to mitigate unintended consequences that this bill could create. In keeping with the precedent of allowing breast reconstruction surgery to be billed under insurance, today we are asking for that same benefit to be excluded or be extended to the women and men suffering from HIV-associated lipodystrophy. Thank you for your time. I'll take any questions if there are any, and I hope you will support this bill.
Any questions? Would you call the panel, please?
Sure.
We have one panel of witnesses for this bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Jim Cox. Farab Kelsang.
Yes.
And Elise Brown.
Just the two of us.
Oh, well, okay. We'll bring Elise up.
I'm sorry.
Go for it.
Chair Greenlick, Health Committee, I want to thank you for this opportunity to be here to show support for House Bill 3086. My name for the record is James Cox. I'm a lifelong Oregonian. I am a father. I'm a grandfather. And I am a long-term AIDS survivor. It's hard to sum up in 3 minutes the impact the last 32 years has had on my life and on my family. What I can tell you is that, like so many of my compatriots, HIV was a death sentence. When I was diagnosed in 1984, I was told that or 1985, I was told that I probably had less than 2 years to live, that I should expect to go blind within about 6 months. My kids were 8 and 9 at the time. I worked for a car dealership. I chose to be honest with them about my health status. I shared what my health status was. This was 1985, before there were any protections. So I've been battling on these issues for 32 years. The dealership chose, once they were advised not to fire me because of their knowledge on the health condition, they chose to eliminate any health coverage for anything that might be HIV related. And that was before we had protections. If you guys had not voted in things, I would not be sitting here before you today. I would have never had the joy of being a grandfather. So I want to thank you for having put some protection in the past, but HIV lipodystrophy is overlooked. I want to let you know, at my lowest point with my second terminal diagnosis, which was 1996, my T-cell count was 1. I did not qualify for any of the drug trials because I wasn't healthy enough to qualify for those drug trials. But because there was a quick release, I started on medication very quickly, and I was very fortunate. It brought me back from death's door. I don't want to sit here and tell you what a hell my life has been. You know, the reality is it has been a very hard 32 years. I buried every single one of my male friends. I buried my partner in 1995, and I hoped to follow him. The meds came out with a T-cell count of 1. My health started rebounding. I had a period of disability for 3.5 years that I was on Social Security disability. And unlike so many of my friends that lost their lives, I came back. I deal with tremendous survivor's guilt as to why I got left behind. I need my life to have meaning. So my response to that was I needed to get out of a world of commission sales, and I needed to do something with whatever time I had left that was going to benefit society. I was fortunate enough to be hired by the Multnomah County Health Department, doing HIV testing, harm reduction counseling, needle exchange, working with at-risk populations, and it gave tremendous meaning, and that helped to booster my immune system. Within about 4 years of working for the health department, I started developing lipodystrophy. At that point in time, I was no longer in the STD clinic. I had been transferred into maternal child and family health, or at the time it was called early childhood services, and my job was to be a welcome baby greeter in 4 of our local hospitals for our state Healthy Start program. So my day consisted of doing baby meet and greets. I worked exclusively with nurses and doctors, and as the lipodystrophy got more pronounced on my face, it became apparent that I had an underlying health issue. There's no way to hide your face. I started developing a buffalo hump. My means to deal with that so I could keep working and be a contributing member of society was I grew my hair out to the middle of my back to try and conceal my hump. I couldn't conceal my face. When I had 2 different nurses at 2 different maternity units ask if I was fighting cancer, I knew that people were already talking. Anyone that was aware of my orientation, you don't assume cancer. They jump to that other assumption, whether it's shared with you or not. And yet I was working in an industry that, or I should say in a community, that it would have been difficult for all the nurses dealing with brand new births, knowing they had somebody with AIDS coming into the room doing these assessments. It shouldn't have mattered, but it would. What I discovered was, unlike all the women that I worked with, because I worked almost exclusively with women nurses, when they had breast cancer, they were treated with compassion because we have a federal act that forces insurance companies to do that. What I found when I took these very same issues to Kaiser, none of it's covered for people like me. To make things more complicated, I work for Multnomah County. Multnomah County, we cover transgender reassignment surgery. Breast cancer is covered. But I'm an AIDS survivor. I don't count. And that's how it felt to me. My life didn't have value to them. I'm not worth coverage. It is a barrier to employment. Right now, with aging and disability services, you have numerous longtime survivors that, unlike myself, didn't get back to work. They've been on disability, and they want to get off now. They've gotten healthy enough to get off, but they have faces and bodies that are scarred by the battle they've been fighting for the last 30 years. And so I highly encourage each and every one of you to have compassion in your hearts and realize that for us, this is no different than breast cancer. I've been blessed. I'd rather talk about my blessings. I was never supposed to see my kids become teenagers. My son is 40 and my daughter's 39. I got to assist in my grandson's birth. That's a gift because legislators protected me. And I need you guys to do it again, because I have a whole group. I was fortunate. I was able to save enough money so I could pay for the Sculptra injections myself to make my face presentable so I could keep working. The buffalo hump, that was, I was on my own until it got to a point that it would restrict my movement enough. All I could do was to try and grow my hair out. I'm a grandfather. I don't want to look like a mutant for my grandson. I just want to be grandpa. And I need you guys to make that possible, not just for me, but for every other long-term survivor that is struggling, and many of them in hiding. There are many people that are in isolation with this virus. They can be contributing members of society. And this is something that the state legislator can do that can have serious impact on the quality of life. And I want to be clear, lipodystrophy is a big issue. When it was the worst for me and there was no help through the insurance companies, my choice was knowing that I was on medications that were saving my life. Against my doctor's advice, like others, I took myself off my HIV medications. I was willing to go if I had to live this way. Luckily, I had a change of thought, and I got back onto the meds. But I want to let you know, I have a robust immune system that is a byproduct of being on these medications. And if we're going to treat HIV, you have to treat the things that come out of it. Because when you don't, what it tells us and what it told me with Multnomah County is I didn't count. My life didn't matter. My contributions were unimportant. And that is so far from the truth. I'm a public health hero. I've dedicated 17 years, and I want you guys to give the same opportunity that I had to my friends and compatriots, because they don't have it, they don't have the resources, and the only way that this is going to happen is if we get everybody behind passing this bill. This is an emergency. Lives are on the line, and we're existing right now in a federal climate that we are a scared community. If we have changes to Medicaid, I can tell you, longtime survivors that I'm lucky to know right now, they will be losing their lives. They have to have access to medications. And I'm saying, let's take this a step further and show them that we're going to do something that actually addresses the stigma of long-term HIV. We're not doing it. I know you'll have the support of Aging and Disability Services, because they're trying to get people like me back to work. And when you look like you have a health issue.
Can I ask you to wrap up, please?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I could talk for an hour. I want to thank you for the time in front of you. If Chair Greenlick, or if any of you have any questions, I am an open book and be more than glad to address those questions.
We really appreciate you sharing your story with us. It matters a lot to us.
I appreciate the opportunity to be alive to do that.
Yes, please.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kelsang Punrap. As you can see, I'm a Buddhist monk. And as James just stated...
Could you try and speak up?
Certainly. Maybe if I move this
microphone a little bit. Some problem.
Is that better?
Yeah.
So as James had mentioned during his testimony, some people who have HIV-related lipodystrophy have hidden themselves away, and I suppose that I fall into that category. So since my face started caving in, after I had allowed my body to be part of many drug trials in the past, I offered my body to be in service of science and humanity, so that way future generations could have medicines available to them. But when I took these medicines, it affected my face and the rest of my body. Of course, you can mostly see it in my face. So it's easier for a person to hide away many times, so in many cases, and I'm definitely one of those people. For the last 15 years, I've been working in Buddhist temples, where I don't have contact with the greater community, and easier to be a hermit monk making stipend pay. But I'm now at a point where I'm feeling well enough to be able to be part of the greater community. I would like to be employed and participating as a member of the community, as someone who is looking to contribute to the society with work. But it does become obvious when I get in front of an employer, a potential employer, that there is an underlying issue. And so I think that this is a major obstacle. It's a major obstacle for me and for many people who are in a similar situation as me, as I am. And I think that as we see the future of medicines coming down the pike for HIV treatment, that it may be an issue for more people in the future because the medicines that are still being made today have the same side effect of facial wasting. So it's basically changed my life in the way that I relate to people, and it's changed my life in my ability to establish secure employment. So I'd like to thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, too, for sharing your story. These are very powerful stories for us, and they make a difference. Any questions?
Kenny Geyer.
Just a quick comment. I want to thank you for your stories, too. My father was diagnosed in 1986, did not survive long enough to suffer from this. The drugs were horrible in those days, so I just lived through that with him, and I just really want to thank you for coming forward with your stories.
Sure. My condolences on the loss of your father.
Thank you.
So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please go wisely.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Elise Brown with America's Health Insurance Plans, and AHIP, as you know, is the National Trade Association of Health Plans across the country. And unfortunately, here in opposition to Senate Bill 3086. So let me just get the tough part out of the way first. And let me first start by saying how much I appreciate the personal stories, heartfelt and hard to listen to. So appreciate that for setting the table today. But as a reminder, the Affordable Care Act requires health plans to cover essential health benefits, which everybody refers to as the EHB. And that all applies to plans in the exchanges, as well as the insurance plans offered in small group and individual market. So House Bill 3086 falls outside of that EHB, which means it's a new mandate for the state. And federal law also requires the states to bear the cost and subsidies for any new state-mandated benefits that exceed the EHB. So I just wanted to remind everybody of that first. The second thing is that in preparation for today's discussion, I did audit my AHIP Oregon members and can tell you that since 2010, that particularly Kaiser and Cambia, I haven't gotten to everybody yet and I plan to do that, but they've been covering HIV-associated lipodystrophy since 2010 when medically necessary. So I wanted to start by saying that, and that I want to continue to work with Representative Malmstrom. Thank you for bringing this important issue to the forefront, and want to continue to work with you and understand more about when these occurrences happened, when they did interact with their health insurance carrier. Was it pre-2010? Has it been recently? Those are some of the questions that we have. And with some time and your indulgence, we'd like to figure out how we can answer some of those questions and help with a solution. So that's what I ask of you all.
Do you have a sense of what medical necessary means in this case?
Yes, I think each plan looks at medical necessity similarly, and the definition that I have is medical necessity means service or treatment that is mandatory to protect and enhance the health status of a patient. So
health
you could
status.
Health status. So if
the health status includes psychological condition as well as physical?
It could be all of those things, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. And that could adversely affect the patient's condition if it was omitted. So if this treatment was omitted, what would be the result for the patient? So these are things, again, that I would request if we have a little more time to work with Representative Malmstrom, we'd like to figure out how we can address what happened. I think the biggest thing is understanding if this all happened with their carrier before 2010, I'm here to tell you that since 2010, I'm sure I'm going to discover that the rest of my AHIP member plans are covering it as a medical necessity. And if that's not the case, I'll be reporting that to you also. So thank you again, and thank you to the earlier folks testifying. I appreciate that. Happy to answer any questions.
Are you working on this with them?
Yes, we're going to continue to work it. For the Kick-Ass PDX folks that are here, if you have people that have been denied, particularly since 2010, please let me know so we can use these as examples and use your networks to connect with me so I can work with the insurance companies.
And I think focusing on what medical necessity needs in terms of health status and taking the psychological and other things into that health status is an important issue. Thank you for your
testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3086 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3268. Madam Minister, you want to tell us what we have, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 3268 comes to you at the request of Representative Kenny Geyer and Representative Peluso, chief sponsors. This repeals provisions directing the Public Utility Commission to administer the Residential Telecommunication Service Program. And we have Representative Peluso here to kick off the discussion.
Kenny Geyer, are you going to join us?
Nope, I'm here.
Please, Representative Peluso.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso, State Representative from House District 50, the great city of Gresham. I will keep my remarks brief, but felt it was important to join you here today on behalf of the low-income people that I serve. The federal government has a program called Lifeline that I consider critical to the health and well-being of our most vulnerable. It is a program that gets phone service to our Medicare population. I'm going to say it right this time, to our Medicaid population for free. With that phone, people have a critical link to better health and services necessary to escape poverty. A phone number is necessary for a housing application. A phone number is critical for a job application. And for those members working with a phone carrier that partners with a health plan, it is also their link to their doctor and care support services. Here's a simple fact that justifies this bill. At least 41 states do not regulate the federal Lifeline program, and in these states, a greater percentage of low-income people eligible for the program get free phones than the percentage in Oregon who do not regulate. I'm kind of shocked that only 1 in 6 Oregonians who are eligible for this program actually receive this valuable service. I won't claim to be an expert on the Public Utility Commission or telecommunications, but there is one thing I am clear about. Oregon has to do better than this for our most vulnerable. I look forward to working with you and with advocates to improve the access to this vital program. Thank you for your time, and should you have any technical questions, I would invite Martin Taylor of Care Oregon here to assist me.
Oh, we'll call the first panel of folks to talk about it.
All righty.
I'll urge everybody to be relatively as brief as they can with the testimony, and we'll go until our committee end at 4:45 and take as many witnesses as we can in that time. Could you call the first panel, please?
Martin Taylor, James Anderson, and Nancy. I'm sorry, Martin, you didn't print very well.
Nancy Judkins.
I'm sorry?
Judkins.
Judkins. Judkins.
Yep. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm here representing Care Oregon, and today I'm very pleased to say Care Oregon's members, along with the CCOs in Southern Oregon, Jackson Care Connected, on the Northwest Coast, Columbia Pacific CCO.
Martin, is the equipment working now?
I don't know if the equipment is working. Not my lane.
I'll go.
So,
sorry, go ahead.
I actually wanted to introduce folks because I know that these are folks that have never been before a committee hearing before, give them a chance to testify and then testify myself. And when I do testify, I'm just going to cover the history of how we ended up here, what I think the decision points in this bill are, and then a brief insight into how the Lifeline program is the future of telemedicine and what we can expect in the future. But before I do that, I really would like to start by letting the members who brought this to Care Oregon and then ultimately to you have an opportunity to testify. So maybe Nancy and then James.
I'm here. I'm really nervous.
You have to introduce yourself, please.
Okay, my name is Nancy Judkins, and I've been with CARE Oregon for the last 7 years. Actually, I've been on their MAC committee down there, and we developed this. Kay started this thing, and she wanted all the members to be able to have phones so they could be call their nurse practitioners or doctors or whatever and not run out of time. They'd be on the phone waiting to get through, and there's the time wears out. It's just no more time. A lot of people, if they can't afford a phone, and to pay for the phone bill, there won't be any food on the table maybe that week. A lot of people. You want to go get on off with that?
Hi, my people. My name is James, and I am a lifetime client for Central City Concern Old Town Recovery. She has a valid point. One thing I heard the lady that was up here prior to me, she mentioned doctors. Obviously, if a client is on the OHP, they're going to be seeing their doctors and their counselors. So, obviously having a phone is critical to making appointments on time. With change of appointments and stuff like that can occur, but and I speak for myself as my testimony. What I add to what we've already expressed to you guys is, I went through a recovery program, a big piece in recovery is then you say when you're in trouble, then you just call your sponsor. I was wearing this because I wanted to show you guys that I have my sponsor in my ear all the time.
You're not alone with that.
That makes my phone critical, man. It's a lifeline, right, as much as a life jacket. So when I'm in trouble, I can call them. And I am not alone. That's the piece that I would like to add to what everybody else has already expressed to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Greenlick, I know you called one other person up, and I think there's some other members that want to testify. I'm going to have
to. Tell us what this is about. It would be helpful.
Yeah, so I'll do that. So let's just start with, I got a little out of my swim lane. I've been in this building for about 20 years working on healthcare policy, and there's some part of this bill that is also a telecommunications issue. I know even in your committee you might be, where is this coming from? This sounds like a telecommunications issue. So I'm not going to be an expert on everything. What I do know is that when our members bring us to them what is a healthcare issue, I need my phone to call my sponsor. I need my phone to manage my care support. I need my phone or I lose my housing. I can't get a job without a phone. When they bring that to us, then our responsibility, if we're going to have a member advisory committee, if we're going to be good, responsible partners with our members, is to do what we can to advocate for them. So today, this really isn't a PUC bill. This isn't a CARE Oregon bill. This is their bill, right? The folks in this room. And we brought a busload of them down, a vanload of them down. Probably could have had 4 vanloads of them down. We didn't do that. This is a really, really important issue to them. So just for the last couple of years, we've been working in homeless shelters with a program called Go Mobile, where we go to homeless shelters and we help people sign up for programs that they're eligible for, including the Lifeline program. And those are folks that really need a cellular phone. They don't have a landline phone. The Lifeline program does not work well in Oregon for folks who need a cellular phone. There's a very low participation rate. They have a very hard time activating their phones. They're often not getting through the eligibility screening because they have an address that other people use, and you can have one phone per address. So we encountered barriers to getting our members into a phone that we knew was critical for their care support. And we weren't satisfied that a state-regulated program that had a participation rate that was 1 in 6 eligible folks, way below the federal average, was of added value. So we brought you the question, does having this under state regulation add value to these folks? Now, I can give you a little bit more history there. This program was started by our member advisory committee. We went and had a partnership with a company called TrackPhone, where our part of that partnership was we only cost us money. TrackPhone got to contact our members who are categorically eligible for the federal phone program, and our members in exchange got free minutes when they called our customer service line and free texting so we could give them text messages to remind them of appointments or manage their health. Karen got nothing out of that other than we had the opportunity to market on behalf of the program, and we had the opportunity to spend our time signing folks up. Long run, there's a care support function. We might down the stream feel like we got some cost avoidance as people get healthier, but that's where we were coming from. We're doing this for our members. It is frustrating to then go into a conversation with a state agency and feel like you need to bring CUB into the room or you need to bring OHA into the room to have standing. I understand we're a company, and sometimes if you're an agency, you go, well, you're in a business partnership with another business that we regulate. But we got treated like there was some corporate interest when we were really just trying to advocate for these members. And as a result, we didn't make progress on the goal of getting more people out of poverty by expanding the phone program. And that's why we're here today. I think you have, as legislators, two decisions to make about this bill. So the first thing I want to say is we've introduced amendments to the bill. The original bill was drafted in a way which removed the revenue source from the bill, and it caught three programs, Lifeline being one of them, but also a program for the deaf. That wasn't our intention. This amendment restores the funding entirely for the program. It simply clarifies that the PUC won't do the eligibility or add any regulations beyond what the federal government requires. So The programs are all refunded, including the additional subsidy for the Lifeline program. These are really your two decision points. The first is, if you have a state agency that essentially manages an additional $3.50, so let me just explain one thing. Sorry about this. The federal program is $9.25 a month per, is how much the carriers get paid per phone. We have an additional tax in Oregon that creates an additional $3.50 per phone. So we essentially enhance the federal program by 25%. Despite the fact that we're enhancing the program by 25%, we have a very low cellular carrier participation, and we have a very low number of eligible folks participating. So your first question is there a value add to the member in having it run through the state? And I would say the value add to the member is only justified if we put more money in, we ought to have more people and more carriers participating. If we can't do that as a state, then we're not adding value. We're just taxing people without adding value. And then the second is, are we adding value having a state regulator for things that are more technical that I'm actually, it's not, that's where it's not my swim lane. I think you do have land carriers that feel like the eligibility process is easier. You have the PUC who's going to tell you they reduce the fraud rate. You even have CUB coming and saying, you know what, we can do a much better job of making sure the phone benefit is good. That's a fair plan if we have a local contact and we couldn't really lobby the federal agency. So first question is it worth doing if we don't improve the number of folks getting the service? And the second question is, if we are getting more folks, is a state regulation worth doing because we're getting those other values? And I actually, the reason I bring it up is I feel like you're going to hear a lot of reasons that aren't about the member, that the program's good. And if the program's good for all these other actors, the carriers, the PUC, CUB, but it doesn't work for the members, I question whether or not we should be doing it. Here's my last comment. This is a moment in time where we're trying to figure out how to manage an existing phone program, but in the next 4 to 6 years, the use of these phones, Lifeline Pro phones, to manage a telehealth service is going to blow up. For the first time starting this year, the phones are now smartphones. They have email, the ability to download apps. Health plans like Care Oregon within the next 4 to 6 years are going to be managing people's health. They're going to have FaceTime capability. They're going to have apps that can navigate to 211 or to, they're also going to store the critical information that those members need every time they have to fill out an eligibility form, whether it's Social Security or income statements. Those phones are going to be their connection to their providers, to us and our customer service. It's going to be an incredibly powerful telecommunication and navigation service. That's what's coming. The question also is, if we are going to run this program as a state, do we want the PUC as a regulatory agency managing that telehealth value? Or is there another agency that's maybe more in health transformation that might be a better fit for it? I don't think that's a question for Tay, because frankly, the same agencies that might be more appropriate for a social service program are struggling with their own eligibility enrollment right now. So I'm not saying today is the day to make that change. But the long-term vision for where this program goes, I think, is moving this into a health management, health transformation corridor, and there may be a more appropriate agency to do that.
Just a quick question. I might have missed this. Who's currently running the program right now?
The PUC.
Okay.
Representative Pack.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah. Thank you all for being here today. I have a couple of questions. When you said there was 1 in 6 actually participate, why the low numbers of participation if we have that many that need the phones?
So my observation working on this the last 2 years is that the framework at the PUC has been a regulatory framework, so they don't have committed resources to promote the phone program. When my experience was that when we had eligibility issues where we had folks who we knew were categorically eligible because they were care working members, about half of the ones that were denied were what I would describe as a false denial. An example was we had a member whose name was Tom and filled out the application as Tom. In the MMIS system, it was listed as Thomas. And in order to be eligible, you have to get an exact match. And so that person was told they weren't eligible for the phone program. So in order for that eligibility system to work, you have to at some point have a person look and say, well, if they're a care worker member and I'm not getting a match, is there an explanation for that? And this really hit hard on our folks who were applying for, if they were a caregiver and they were applying for someone else, or if they were in a group home setting like a women's crisis shelter or a homeless shelter. That was a big part of it. And then frankly, the land carriers do really well. So CenturyLink will tell you that land carriers have a great eligibility process with the state regulation. The cell carriers really don't. Their applications are done differently, and you have to mail the phone. And I could explain it technically, but I think the biggest gap is that we've all gone cellular. And as we go cellular, the program working really well for landlines and really poorly for cellular lines is having an impact.
Follow up?
Yeah.
Thank you. So who, if not the PUC, who will be the regulatory agency over making sure that the phones get to the people that actually need them?
Yeah. So the theory is that the PUC is actually creating additional constraints that are making it hard to get the phone out, and that if we just went and did what 41 other states did, which is let the federal government regulate the program, that the marketplace of phone carriers would grow and that we would market these phones aggressively in the state and we would come up to the national average. The bill, as amended, actually keeps the revenue source in place. It protects the programs for the deaf and the internet. By keeping the revenue and some program in the PUC, the question is, can the PUC now, with that revenue, become an agent for promoting the phone, which I think is the next conversation for us to have. So they won't be in charge of regulating. Under the amendments, they're not in charge of regulating or the eligibility, but they will have the subsidy, the additional state subsidy to add to the phone, and some staff that can now go to promoting the program.
I just want to make a quick statement. Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I actually have to leave at 4, which I let them know about ahead of time. I'm sorry I'm not here for the whole and the whole testimony, and I'll watch it later. I just want to thank you, Martin, for working on this so hard, and for the CARE Oregon members for coming and representing the many people who, the 5 out of 6 out there who are not getting the phone for purposes that you've stated, as well as follow-up appointments, all those kinds of things. Thank you also to Rep. Peluso and Senator Boquist, who are the co-chiefs. We never intended for this to take away services to the deaf community. So I want to make that clear. There are a lot of people in the room here that I work with a lot on other issues. And that was not understanding exactly how the PUC operates. So we have a big commitment to making sure that this doesn't impact other communities while at the same time we get more phones out. And so I've talked to several people in for phone carriers industry. Have not talked to everyone, but I know that Martin is in the process of talking to PUC and CUB and others, and we want to get this right, but I think it's a really important issue. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for holding this hearing.
You see a way to a pathway to improve.
Yes, and I think the amendment goes a long way there, but it just recently came out, and so we really want to discuss it with people. And there may be ideas about how to get to it in a different way. So I think the goal is the important thing.
Yep.
I'd like to continue to work on that. Thank you.
Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. First, Martin, thanks for bringing this to our attention. Thanks, Representative Russo. If I follow this right, so Lifeline is a federal program, correct? Mm-hmm. And we have one of the lowest utilization rates in the country.
That's right.
But we charge extra.
Yes.
So where's that money going? Where is it ending up?
Representative Bueller, that's a terrific question, and I would suggest that if the PUC testify, you ask them. I don't know.
Okay. Bring him back.
Hope they're here.
Well, we have a PUC person to talk to us. Why don't we call him next?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, guys.
It was kind of
John Cray. From the Public Utility Commission. Do you want me to bring somebody else up with it?
No.
Okay.
Thank you very much for being here, Mr. Cray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is John Cray, and I'm the Residential Service Protection Fund at the Program Manager at the Oregon Public Utility Commission. The Oregon Telephone Assistance Program is the state counterpart to the Federal Communication Commission Lifeline Program and is collectively known as Oregon Lifeline. We administer this federal and state program that makes telecommunication service more affordable to more than 60,000 qualifying low-income Oregonians. The FCC provides $9.25 per month, and the state of Oregon provides an additional $3.50. Eligible low-income Oregonians can receive Lifeline in the form of a monthly discount on their landline or wireless service, or they can receive a monthly allotment of free minutes. A total of 34 companies, six of which are wireless, participate in the Oregon Lifeline program. The Communication Act of 1934, as amended in 1996, gives state commissions the authority to determine whether a company meets the federal criteria to provide Lifeline service in their state as an eligible telecommunication carrier. Oregon Lifeline is funded through the Residential Service Protection Fund. In addition to Oregon Lifeline, the Residential Service Protection Fund also supports the Oregon Telecommunication Relay Service and the Telecommunication Devices Access Program. The Residential Service Protection Fund has its own fund limitations and is only used to support the three programs, staffing levels of 8 FTE, administrative overhead, and 10% of one utility staff member that works on FCC and eligible telecommunication carrier issues in support of the Oregon Lifeline program. The current surcharge on landline and wireless customers is 7 cents and is significantly lower than their 35-cent statutory maximum. Proportionally, the funds allocated between the three programs have remained fairly consistent over bienniums, and Oregon Lifeline funds are not being strained or directed to fund the other two programs. A low-income customer can qualify for the Oregon Lifeline program if their total household income is at or below 135% of the federal poverty guidelines, or if they participate or receive benefits from one of the following: Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, Medicaid, Supplemental Security Income, Federal Public Housing Assistance, or Veteran or Survivor's Pension. The recent amendment implies that the eligibility criteria in Oregon is inconsistent with FCC eligibility criteria. This is inaccurate. In addition to informing customers of all their options, we perform several administrative functions in making sure that the customer is eligible to receive Lifeline in accordance with FCC regulations. We ensure that companies comply with program rules, and we assist customers daily in resolving any and all Lifeline questions, concerns, or complaints that are brought to our attention. If the Oregon PUC were no longer to perform eligibility function, the responsibility will default to the 34 companies that participate in the program. The companies would be under the same requirement to confirm eligibility, except they would not have access to state databases that aid in verification. As a result, the customer may be subject to additional requirements to provide proof of eligibility and identity to the company. Companies are required to advertise the availability of Lifeline, and it's in their interest to do so. Even though participation rate appeared low in Oregon, 16% in 2015, the participation rate in other states ranges from 1% to 52%. We are not aware of any study that explains the reason for the variation in the participation rates among states. Nevertheless, we do promote the program and are willing to work with CARE Oregon and other stakeholders to identify ways to increase participation and inform qualifying low-income Oregonians of all their options for receiving Lifeline service that meet the various needs. Customers' choice is driven by the market and the companies that offer Lifeline service. Generally, it's the company's decision whether to offer Lifeline in Oregon. Different companies offer different choices to their customers. For example, iWireless offers more free minutes to the qualifying customer as a result of Oregon's $3.50. Other companies don't offer free plans. Instead, they provide a discount equal to the federal and Oregon subsidy on whatever calling plan the customer chooses. There have been many documented cases and substantiated reports of waste, fraud, and abuse across the country due to the free Lifeline model at no charge to the customer. After a public rulemaking process, the Oregon Public Utility Commission adopted safeguards in which low-income customers, upon receipt of the handset from the company of their choice, must contact the company and provide the last four digits of their social security number to activate the free monthly Lifeline service, akin to credit card activation. Three out of the four companies subject to this requirement had no compliance issues. CARE Oregon alleges that TracFone left the Oregon Lifeline market due to this requirement, but TracFone did not petition the Oregon Public Utility Commission for relief or propose another solution. CARE Oregon also states that 45% of TracFone handsets were not activated. However, neither CARE Oregon nor TracFone provide an explanation as to why. Our concern is that many handsets may not have been delivered to the intended recipient, and in which case the requirement protects the program from potential waste, fraud, and abuse. Not only does the Oregon Public Utility Commission provide an added value of $3.50 to the Lifeline program, we, based on our 30-year experience, have the administrative, regulatory, and legal expertise to administer this federal and state program. We advocate for Oregonians in FCC proceedings, and the FCC, in response, has commended Oregon as a model state in the administration of the Lifeline program. We strive to ensure that the funds collected for the program are used in the most efficient manner to benefit the maximum number of Oregonians. In the meantime, we welcome CARE Oregon and other interested individuals and stakeholders to provide input on how we can improve participation by reaching more low-income Oregonians. Although we have no position on the bill at this time, we wanted to provide a factual overview of the program. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony. I welcome any questions or concerns you may have.
Are there any questions?
I do.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. So just to clarify, if the PUC doesn't regulate and it's open to the carriers, could the carriers require additional information from the consumers, and could they potentially be charged additional money or be put into different plans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hack, if the Oregon PUC were no longer to oversee the program, the responsibility would default to the carriers, and the carriers would have to be subject to the same federal requirement that we apply. So, like, they would require the customer's name, 4 digits of the Social Security number, proof of eligibility, proof of identity that we already have access to via databases. I hope I answered your question.
Can I follow up?
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm trying to understand is, would there be a potential for consumers to have to provide additional information to the carriers that they don't already have to provide through the PUC or be subject to? What I think I'm hearing from you is that we could actually create additional problems for consumers that we aren't intending to do.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hack, thank you for clarifying. The company, okay, for example, okay, we have access to the Department of Human Services database. We can verify that they're receiving SNAP, Medicaid, or supplemental security income. If the companies were to perform that function, they will require the customer to supply the actual physical proof and proof of their identity, which is not
could
necessary.
Delay the, which could delay the actual receiving of
potentially,
the phone.
Potentially, yes, it could. And an additional cost to the consumer, I would say no, but to the carrier, perhaps.
Representative Bueller?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlick. I'll ask a similar question I asked Mr. Taylor. I'm having a hard time understanding what value the PUC provides with this extra tax, considering our very low utilization rate of the Lifeline phones.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, I may have to ask you to clarify what you mean by extra tax. The surcharge provides support to the three programs, including Oregon Lifeline. Would you please clarify?
Sure. So extra tax over what other states
only
have
federal.
What other states get from federal sources, considering that we have one of the lowest utilization rates, where's the value for that increased tax being devoted to Lifeline in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, thank you for clarifying. Other states do provide additional monies for their state, like low-income customers. They use money from the Universal Service Fund, even though in Oregon it's called the Residential Service Protection Fund. I hope that answers your question.
Would you point out that there are three programs that are involved in this, in addition, that are covered by that subsidy?
I do need that.
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct. The surcharge supports the three programs.
Could you explain the three programs?
Sure. Okay. Their first program, Oregon Lifeline.
I got that.
Okay. Okay.
Well, I guess Mike may clarify.
Yeah.
Well, I'm confused on it. I want to make sure we have an apples to apples comparison to what's going on in other states. So, my understanding of what you just said is that other states also supplement the federal Lifeline funds with some other source of state-based revenue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, yes, and they do so in the form of a line item on their telecommunication bill, similar to Oregon.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I just have one more.
Let her go ahead of me. It's okay. It might help me.
Okay.
I'd like some time to get some more witnesses.
Okay. Do we have... So who will oversee the information that people have to provide that's personal and private to them, like the qualification for SNAP and all those different programs to the private providers? I'm just curious because there's no oversight.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hack, if the PUC were no longer involved, it would, the FCC, I assume, would be responsible for overseeing that aspect.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cray, thank you for being here. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. If my interest is trying to make sure that we change the ratio from 1 in 6 Oregonians having access to this to getting something to more like 1 in 3, mm-hmm. how would you suggest that I legislate that or make that happen? Since I'm out of my swim lane as well, to use a, you know, and I mean, no disrespect to your agency. I have no idea, you know, what the regulatory framework is for what you do. But, like, if I'm interested as a legislator in getting more of these phone minutes available to other folks, how can we help your agency do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nasi, I hope
it's okay.
Okay. How you can assist is providing the Public Utility Commission with funding, approved funding, to contract with marketing firms, outreach groups, to try to increase participation in the program. And perhaps we can do a study to determine why the participation rate in Oregon is low.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair, and then we'll let... So, if I understand you correctly, the issue is you don't have enough resources to make it more available to people, even though other states maybe are putting less resource in as well, but more people are getting it. Is that fair?
Mr. Chair, Representative knows the phone companies are required to advertise the availability of Lifeline service. Okay. The PUC also strives to promote the program.
Okay.
God. Thank you.
All right. I think we're going to have an opportunity to be interacting with you for a while. And it'd be very helpful to us if you see if you can work further with the folks and see what we can do to help make the process better.
Mr. Chair, that would be excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you call the next panel of witnesses, please?
And this is from the opponent's side.
All right.
Chad Ludwig, Stephen Brown, Jerry Fleming, Jr.
Please. Please try and be as brief as possible.
Hello, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chad Ludwig. I am president of Oregon Association of the Deaf. I want to thank the team who worked on developing the amendment to this bill because that addressed our original concern. Oregon Association of the Deaf is still opposed to the amendment due to the fact that not one time in the past 4 years has the Lifeline program advertised to the deaf and hard of hearing community. We've been left in the dark. We don't know about the benefits of the program in any capacity. We only know about those benefits because it is in the same program with the other two programs. It is in that group of funding. So those two other programs do keep us informed. So if the funding is split off, we would be completely in the dark. So I'm asking you to oppose the original and amendments to this bill. Hello. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. Good to see you all again. I know that I've met a few of you several times in the past. I would like to say that I'm opposed to this bill.
Name, please.
There
Tell your name for the record.
My apologies. Thank you for the reminder. My name is Stephen Brown. I am the Vice President of Oregon Association of the Deaf, and I'm a registered lobbyist. Thank you for reminding me. I'm opposed to this bill. Since 1987, the Residential Services Fund has been running successfully. It is a strong program. The charges that they provide are fair. The regulations and services that they provide are fair, and they are able to run that agency successfully. This bill is asking us to shut down and essentially abolish the relay service, the TTY distribution program, the telecommunication program, and landline and lifeline program. This affects thousands of people in Oregon. I think the first two programs that I mentioned, many people use the services, use those phone services that are provided. Lifeline program, I'm not sure about that. It's been new information to hear about the addition, and it's new information to me to learn about the low number of participation. And essentially, the deaf community has been in the dark. We don't have any familiarity with that Lifeline program. I think that the program should be abolished, not because we haven't heard of it before, but because that will impact other programs. And we need to be able how to figure out how to approve these and how to improve the Lifeline program as it remains under the PUC. So that is my recommendation.
Representative Nose.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to make my question brief. Our problem is that it seems to not be working for the Lifeline folks. And can one of you explain just again why we can't leave your programs in place and separate out the Lifeline program and just deal with that separately? I understand it's working for you all. I'm glad. It's not working for these folks, and maybe we want to try a different approach.
I was also made aware that the proposed amendment by Martin, he gave me a copy of this, and I was reading it very quickly. It seems the amendment is essentially fair. It seems that it does make sense. And as your constituent in your representative district, Representative Nose. Yes. So I do just want to let you know personally that I do support this amendment, but I also want to speak as a representative of the deaf community, and as Oregon Association of the Deaf, we oppose this amendment. So
okay.
I would like to tell you and encourage other members of the committee that we need a way to figure out how to make this a fair deal and how to make it a winning bill for both sides.
Let's hear from the third witness.
Hello, Chairperson and Committee members. My name is
Gerald Fleming, Jr. People call me Jerry, so hello. I'm the state representative for Deaf Grassroots Movement of Oregon. We have over 660 members. We did have a vote against our members, and we are strongly opposed by our members, and we are strongly opposed. The amendment was written a few days after we had voted, and I just want to say that to you, and that's all I have.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to reiterate for the record that the first bill that came out inadvertently cut the program. We didn't understand how this program worked very well, and so we eliminated the funding for it, saying this should just fall under the federal regulation, and did not realize that it funded the other two programs, which is very important to the deaf community. And so the attempt in the Second Amendment is simply to say it doesn't deal with the revenue issue, which Martin has raised, as if you're not going to have the PUC administer this program, should we cut back that $3.50 state job, state piece that goes to Lifeline and have it only, the remaining part, only go to the other two programs? Or would we want to continue that state funding because maybe they could help market it in some way? But the administering of the program would be as 41 other states do.
I'd like to get some more witnesses.
Okay. I just want to clarify that it doesn't hurt at all. It doesn't take away any funding, doesn't do anything to the other programs. So I want to clarify that First Amendment because it just came out, and so it may not be clear yet.
Would you call the next panel of witnesses?
Go back to the
Yeah.
John Sherman and Sandy De La Rosa.
Is that all the opponents?
Oh, let me see. And Matt D.
There's somebody from Cub that opposes. Cub opposes. The Citizens Utility Board. There it is. The consumer.
Please introduce yourself.
Just hang on.
Somebody.
Hello. This is the first time I've been exposed to any kind of situation like this. So
you're doing great.
Excuse me. My name is John Sherman. I work for Transition Projects in Portland, Oregon. We're a nonprofit agency that our thing that we go by is from homelessness to housing and everything in between. There's kind of no beginning and no end to what we do there, but what I do is I'm a peer health navigator. It's a new role with our agency that I've been given, me and my partner have been given to kind of create as we go. How this has affected people that I've been working with in this new role has been real significant. I didn't know coming down here really what we were coming into, and it was kind of, we were kind of briefed on it with the doors flying open on the van and like all this other stuff. So anyhow, it happened. Just the other day, I had a client. Okay, so I help people. I help people get to their doctor's appointments, dental appointments, mental health appointments, addiction services, things like that, and basically try to keep people out of the emergency rooms as a first resort because that can be very, very costly. Just the other day, I'm at the desk at one of my clients' doctor's offices, and they're like, "What's your contact information?" And he looks at me, and I'm like, "I guess it's me," because he doesn't have a phone. He's not able to get a phone, and he doesn't know why. He's just not really a whole lot of information out there for people that are, you know, vulnerable like this gentleman. And so I became his contact information, and it's a good thing because he has Medicaid, and he stays in one of our shelters. He has Medicaid, and there was some stuff that needed to be, or some paperwork that needed to be renewed, and had they not had my personal number to contact, to use as a contact, the lady from Medicaid wouldn't have been able to get in touch with him, and all sorts of stuff would have happened from there. He wouldn't have been able to get his meds. He's got, he's on dialysis, like all this other stuff. So that's just kind of like one example how the individuals that I work with really, really need access to these phones. Just if nothing else, just so that their healthcare providers can contact them and not hope that I'm at work at that time or available. Because it's just one of me, and there's a whole lot of people that are literally banging down the doors of our agency, looking for help. So that's just an example of what I have here.
Thank you. You did great.
Thank you.
Who's next?
I'm Sandy De La Rosa. This is not my first time. I was just here last week with Mac D regarding Oregon Health Plan. To make my story long story short, once again, as far as Lifeline, I don't need to use it anymore, but it helped me get off the streets. My story regarding Oregon Health Plan and how it's tied to Lifeline also is I didn't need OHP, I didn't need Lifeline until I lost it all, because I had it all, the house, the cars, traveling the world, but that all came to an end when my significant other, 16 years, ended it. So it can happen to any one of you, any one of us in this courtroom, in this setting. However, Oregon Health Plan helped me literally get back on my feet, because I've been in a wheelchair for 3 years. I'm just starting to learn how to walk. So the services provided at Old Town Clinic, Central City Concern has helped me. But another key is Lifeline also, because when I did find myself homeless on the street, my only lifeline was the Lifeline phone. And I got that call. And if I had not had that call, somebody else would have got that housing, and I'd have been on the streets longer. So even though the Lifeline doesn't apply to me anymore, I do know others, and I do speak for others. For example, my significant other, he suffers of mental illness. He's just coming out of his episode. He was off his meds. He's now back on meds. But his Lifeline is the phone. He has a hard time getting out of the house, talking to people. But he does use the phone to contact his counselor, to call a psychiatrist, to talk to the pharmacy, to his mother, his support team. And as far as what I heard from, is it PUC mm-hmm. representative? It's not advertised, okay? And as far as how easy it is to get one phone, I'm computer literate, but some of these people are not, and they're vulnerable, you know, they have anxiety. I looked it up because my significant other, he's coming back into the picture, was panicking. You know, he's not going to have his phone, so he's going to lose, you know, and his counselor's leaving. And so it actually disrupted his routine he's getting back in, you know, and when they get triggered, it can spiral backwards, and he could fall through the cracks. So I assisted him trying to get him this Lifeline phone, and I'm computer literate. I think the best example would have been to bring one of the smartphones and for us to call to activate it. That would have been a good example to show you how it is not easy to get activated. Also, they refer you to the website, which I have a smartphone, and I went to the website. They require you to get your documentations, take photos. They don't have smartphones to, you know. And it requires going to DHS. My significant other can't even get out of the apartment, so how can he go to DHS to go get the paperwork? How can he go to Social Security to go get the paperwork to submit this to Lifeline? So perhaps for me it might be easy, but for those that are vulnerable, it is not easy. And even though I might not need Lifeline, there's a lot of other people that still do. And also, I'm seeing this example of other states. Well, if it's working for them, shouldn't we copy them? And, you know, to me, you know, there's more success rate with other states, so why don't we ask them how they're doing it, and why don't we copy them to help the others that are still, they have potential too to get back on their feet. Like, I was a client, now I'm not a client. I'm now a volunteer, I lead a group. I'm on the HSAC committee, which is the Health Services Advisory Council. They're at Central City Concern, you know, and Lifeline is exactly that. It's a lifeline. Good. Thank you.
Please introduce yourself.
I love hearing Sandy speak. You know, my name is Mac D. I'm from the Central City Concern. I'm a peer leader. I'm a homeless advocate. I am homeless. You know, I represent thousands of people in this state who have no access to a laptop. My God, what did you do to me? You know, I got to tell you that this is a lifesaver, you know. I understand that at first it made sense to, you know, perhaps, you know, put this responsibility in the hands of the PUC. But we're talking rehabilitation issues. We're talking recovery issues. We're talking health issues. You know, my phone is a health aid. You know, and I think that, you know, we need to put the responsibility into the hands of those more appropriate with our healthcare concerns. I think, you know, that, you know, they really believe in what they're doing and the good that comes from it. I think that, you know, we really need to, make the main thing the main thing. And it's not what it is, it's what it does. And it gives us, you know, access to social services. It gives us access to sociability in itself. You know, I could call my mom. I could do, you know, there's things I could do with the phone. And you know, my health care needs, you know, are tantamount to me. You know, I program like every day in my recovery, my rehabilitation. You know, my phone is so necessary, whatever like that. You know, and the PUC, I don't even know why they give a shit. You know, this is a health issue. And I think it belongs in the hands of health care professionals. Thank you.
Is there an attack?
Thank you, Chair. My question's to Sandy. And I'm just going to throw this as kind of a wild thought, but I'm just going to throw it out there. If the phones were available at the CCOs where you go and receive your care, would people be more apt to get the phone there because they're there and they're
most
at the moment?
Definitely.
Have we not? Maybe we ought to have a conversation about that. Just because the goal is
that's
to
actually
put it
a brilliant idea.
The hands of the people that need it the most. Just
we're going to have to bring this to a close. 4:45 deadline. I really apologize to folks that have come to testify and haven't had the chance, but I think we've got a feeling for what the problem is. Both sides are two groups of people that have real interest here. I think you've done a wonderful job presenting your story. I think it helps us commit to working with the folks to see if we can find our way to improve both pieces of this program, to make sure we don't hurt people who are being served already. So I really thank you very much for coming down. I know it's always a scary job to testify, except for the lobbyists who seem to thrive on it. Thank you all very much. I'm going to close the public hearing. House Bill 3268.
Thank you.
Representative Kenny Geyer to continue working on this and see if we can get something. And again, thank you all for coming.
Thank you. Even where they are, right?
Yeah.
We are adjourned.
Dead man.
Well, and it's easier. Like, let's not be so
adjourned.
Dead man.
Well, and it's easier. Like, let's not be so